It is appropriate that your moderator did give you the topic, so you will know at least what I'm supposed to be talking about. Any correlation between that and what we end up talking about may turn out to be an accident. I have a few notes here. The first one says, Reverend Lehman, that theologians have agreed that all of that trouble in the Garden of Eden was not caused by a big red apple at all. It was caused by a green pear. We will put away the notes and talk about the operation of selective service for a moment. I'm not here to defend American foreign policy. I'm not here to tell you that some wars are more just than others. I'm here primarily to acquaint you with the mechanics and the operation of selective service. If you are interested in foreign policy, or if you are interested in what you think should be changed in our manpower policies in this country, I think it best that you understand how the present act is operating. We're operating primarily under the Universal Military Training and Service Act of 1948. The draft in this country for 25 years has been headed up by one man, Lieutenant General Louis B. Hershey. Frankly, the law under which we are presently operating was written almost entirely by General Hershey. In order to understand how it operates, let me tell you a little bit about our organization and a few of the fundamentals on which we are guided at the present time. The 25-year history of the selective service system has seen relatively few changes. In this day of centralized power in Washington and of computerized operation of governmental agencies, selective service is unique. We still operate with the local draft board as the backbone of our program. The draft board typically in Minnesota consists of 5 members. We have a few in some of the smaller counties with only 3 members. These draft board members serve without compensation. Many of them have served for many, many years in the capacity of local board members. We have 131 local boards in the 87 counties in Minnesota, at least one local board in every county. And of course, in the metropolitan areas, in Ramsey County, for example, we have 12 local boards. As I say, primarily a 5-man board. We have a few 6-man boards, and we have a few down as low as 3-man boards. It's a grassroots organization, in other words. And my job as state director is really not to induct nor to classify anyone. The induction is accomplished by the armed forces, and the classification which precedes induction is accomplished by the local board. And frankly, these local boards are pretty autonomous. Each one is guided by general rules and principles that we attempt to lay down for them in classifying the manpower pool of their particular area or county. But as I say, they are pretty autonomous. They may individually decide the classification of any young man who is registered within their jurisdiction. At the present time, we are inducting registrants between the ages of 19. This is the lowest age. We cannot induct below the age of 19. And 25. This is the top age at the present time in our present framework of operation. We cannot induct a 26-year-old. Now, there are a few very rare exceptions of delinquents and a few like that. But in Minnesota, we have not inducted 26-year-olds, and we have not inducted 18-year-olds. Under the law, we start with the oldest man within that 19 to through 25-year bracket, who is 1A and has been found acceptable for military duty by the armed forces. Now, in order to understand just how this operates, you have to realize that the armed forces determine acceptability. I do not. We simply classify the young man, send him to the armed forces for determining whether he is acceptable for military service, physically, mentally, and morally. That determination is outside of my control, but rests with the armed forces examining station. Most of our boys in Minnesota are examined here in Minneapolis, down on Washington Avenue. There is an examining station in almost every state, and those examining stations are not a part of selective service. Once the armed forces examining station decides a man is not acceptable, physically, mentally, or morally, or any combination of those three, our local boards have no alternative than to take him out of 1A. He can't stay in 1A once it has been determined that he is not acceptable by the armed forces. Now, during days of small requirements for manpower, our local boards could afford to be very liberal in classification. As a matter of fact, there was a time within the last 18 months when local boards were literally looking for reasons to defer people and not to put them in 1A. The requirement of the armed forces for manpower through the draft was so small that actually we were able to defer many, many men and not worry about it because we could reach our relatively small manpower requirements. For example, in December of 1964, we were required to induct less than 200 men. In January, less than 200 men. In February of 65, Minnesota's call was for only 70 men. That's 7-0, that's all, in the whole state. That was our share of the number of 1A acceptable men available. We were required to induct only 70. Well, obviously, in a situation like that, many young men who were not deferred because they were not students, they were not fathers, they were not farmers, they were not anything that gave them a deferment. Obviously, many of those boys, when the call was so small, escaped induction and military service simply by attaining the age of 26. Time just solved the problem as far as the draft is concerned for those boys. Now, I don't say that it solved the problem well, because during that time span, from age 19 through 25, these boys were always faced with a potential induction which never came. And I do not defend that procedure. I wish we could come up with a better procedure during times of real small induction calls, back where we get 70, for example, in a month, where the national call was only 3,000. And you see, these calls are determined not by us, but by the Secretary of Defense telling us how many men are needed through the draft. Now, during this time then, when the calls were small, we were still classifying people. We were still sending people in for examination, and they were being examined. And then they just came home, and they were not being inducted, very many of them, real small number, 200 or less. Many months, less than 100. The manpower pool within this age and acceptability framework thus became larger and larger. You continue to examine and classify people and put them in the pool, put them on the shelf, don't call them, and they simply sit there. Larger and larger numbers of men available. Okay. Last July, the president was faced with a decision. Well, first, of course, was the decision, what military emphasis are we going to give in Vietnam? And you know what the answer was to that, as far as the White House is concerned. Then, the next decision, are we going to fill this manpower requirement, if it is going to be large, relatively large anyway, through the mobilization of the reserve and the National Guard, or are we going to leave the National Guard and the reserve untouched, for the moment at least, and rely upon the draft giving us the manpower that we need? And of course, in July of 65, the president announced that he was not contemplating the recall of reserve and National Guard people, but instead was going to rely on the draft and was going to materially step up the number of inductions. And in August, last August, our call went to 700, and in September to 800, and in October to 900, November at 900. December, our call went down a little bit to 814, I believe it was. January, it fell again, just over 700. I'm talking now about Minnesota's fair share of the national induction call. In April, our call was just over 400. In May, it went up just a little bit over 400. In June, we will be inducting just a few less than 300. July, nobody knows, or at least we in Selective Service don't know what our call will be for next July. Now, what has happened? Our call has risen very sharply, you see, from 100 and less to 900 and slightly more. And along with this, as your moderator said, I'm fairly new in this business. Something happened that I didn't think would ever materialize to the extent that it did. Along with these 900 induction calls, the recruiting services experienced the bonanza. And the number of men who rushed in to volunteer was considerably in excess, almost twice the number that we were called on to induct. And every time a Minnesota boy enlists, I get a report in October where we induct 900, we saw 1,600 more Minnesota registrants enlist. In other words, Minnesota in October did not put 900 boys into service in the Army for 2 years through the draft period. They put 900 boys into the Army for 2 years, and 1,600 boys, Minnesota registrants, into the service for a longer period than 2 years through the recruiting service, through the enlistment process. Now, these kids are volunteers. I put that word in quotes. We agitated them enough that the recruiters were literally unable to handle to take the orders. And many of the recruiters told me they weren't selling anything, they were simply taking orders. And this continued on. In November, where we inducted 900, we had 1,600 again, additionally, voluntarily, unquote, enlist. In December, our call was down a little bit and the recruiters went down a little bit. Nobody likes to enlist in December. In January, our call went down. The recruiters still had a terrific month. Long about now, this month in May, several recruiters have told me they will not meet their quota. In June, they'll have no problem meeting their quota, numbers-wise, with graduation coming on, and many people looking for the GI Bill benefits and so on. You're going to have no problem in the recruiting services. The point is this, that where we were inducting 900, the Selective Service was responsible for at least 65% of the other 1,600, because 65% of those volunteers were 1A examined and acceptable already by us. They were just that far before getting their greeting. So you see, we were putting men in very rapidly. And this 1A pool that I mentioned was dissipated in a big, big hurry because of the increased enlistments as well as the increased inductions. Okay? Now, our calls are down. I don't think it's because peace has broken out all over the world. I think it's simply because the logistical support for the number of boys that have rushed to service in the last 6 months cannot accommodate anymore. And my prediction, and I may be wrong, and it's just a personal feeling, that we may see some larger calls come fall when the present crop of basic recruits are graduating and being assigned to their units. So where you hear that there's only one chance in 6 or 10, I believe Senator Kennedy said, of a man being drafted, that's a lot of malarkey. Because today, now this may have been true, this may have been true last February of 65, but today we have approximately 3,000 registrants becoming 19 every month in Minnesota. Of these 3,000, about 1,000, I'm sorry to say, will be rejected upon examination in Minnesota. That's a little high. It's been as low as 28% rejection. It's been as high as 42 or 3% in Minnesota. But approximately, of these 3,000 new 19-year-olds every month, approximately 1,000 of them will be rejected by the armed forces, not by us. Another 700 will be deferred. Students, fathers, essential industry, divinity, the usual things, you know, the most common reasons for deferment. And the remainder of about 1,300 will become affiliated with the military in some capacity or other, either through induction or enlistment or ROTC or joining the National Guard or joining the Reserve. These figures that I've been giving of 1,600 a month enlisting in Minnesota do not include the great number that also enlisted in the National Guard and the Reserve. I'm talking just about the active duty establishment. So you see, today, if the call stays about where it is, of 3,000 men, 1,000 will be rejected, 700 will be deferred, and 1,300 will go in uniform in some form or other. So don't get the idea that only one in six. This may have been, but it is no longer true. It's no accident that the graduating seniors at this institution and all over the country this year are paying a great deal more attention to OCS and things like that than last year's class. Now, the manpower needs dictate what we call, and these enlistments do indirectly come to our credit because our 1A pool, you see, was gone. Some of the other states where the enlistment figure was not quite as big did not enjoy this reduction in involuntary enlistments that we are experiencing in Minnesota. Our kids, by and large, are inquisitive. They're looking for the best deal, and they go out and enlist rather than be inducted. Okay. Now, just a word on students. Of course, you must realize that any deferment is just that. It is not an exemption. There are very few people who are exempt from the draft. There are very few. And we don't know what our manpower requirements are going to be even next July, let alone a year from July. I don't think anybody knows what our call is going to be that far in advance. So we simply have to be ready to reclassify people rapidly, and we can't afford to be as liberal as we were there a year ago February, where we weren't inducting anybody, so it was an academic subject who was 1A and who wasn't. And it's no longer an academic subject, it's for real. And we have to be ready to meet large calls. Now, I don't say that we are going to induct large numbers of students. We simply have to be prepared and to have as much information available to the local boards if it becomes necessary to tighten up on deferments. There are in excess of 45,000 2Ss in Minnesota right today. Many of those boys will be graduating this year. Many of them have been examined already. Many of them will go into 1A shortly after graduation. A deferment is in the national interest. It's not as an accommodation to the individual. It's something that a local board does in the national interest and not to accommodate the desires of a person in order to remain in school, in industry, in agriculture, or what have you. Now, this is just a real quick overview of what is going on, and then later on, perhaps we can get into your questions as to the problems, of which I am first to admit we have many, many, in operating the Selective Service today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Colonel Knight. I, as moderator, I should know the rules. Am I allowed to smoke? Oh, all right. Thank you, Matt. That's what my mother always told me. Mr. Lynn Kastner is the executive director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. He came to that position from a post as assistant director of the Governor's Human Rights Commission, a liberal arts graduate and law school graduate of the University of Minnesota. Mr. Kastner speaks on the American Civil Liberty Union positions on protest, conscientious objection, and the draft.
I'd like to in turn start by introducing our excellent moderator, who is Reverend Robert Lehman of the First Unitarian Society in Minneapolis and formerly a board member of the New Mexico Civil Liberties Union. The American Civil Liberties Union was formed in 1920 at a time when many American men and women suffered repressions for the thoughts they had, the speech they gave. And in 1966, men and women are going to jail for what they think, what they speak, and what they feel. The protests surrounding our policy in Southeast Asia, the protests surrounding our policies of selective service, have had nationwide repercussions. The American Civil Liberties Union last October issued a statement evaluating and discussing some of the effects of the reaction to protest, protest protected by the First Amendment to our Constitution. I think all of you know what the American Civil Liberties Union posture is in regard to the right to protest. I think rather than going over this with you and with our audience, I'd like to instead spend a few minutes in the first part of my talk going over some of the specific examples of repression that have occurred across the country and which the American Civil Liberties Union and its affiliates have undertaken the defense. After talking about the right to protest briefly, I'm going to try and cover the right to conscientiously object to a particular war, the arguments that say that burning of one's draft guard, symbolic speech, is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution, and the amendment to the draft law making this a crime is unconstitutional. And lastly, speaking briefly about a selective service regulation which forbids any person appearing before their hearing of having the assistance of counsel, that this regulation is unconstitutional. First is to the reprisals and the repression surrounding right to protest. Second Lieutenant Henry Howe was sentenced by a five-man court-martial to 2 years imprisonment at hard labor, a dishonorable discharge, and forfeiture of all pay and allowances on a conviction of disrespect and conduct unbecoming an officer for demonstrating against American policy in Vietnam. During his off-duty hours, Lieutenant Howe, wearing civilian clothes, participated in an El Paso anti-war demonstration. One charge against Lieutenant Howe was dropped, that he was promoted disloyalty and disaffection among his troops. The American Civil Liberties Union is representing Lieutenant Howe. Recently, he was admitted to bail. It is my understanding that this is the first time that a person in the services under such proceedings have been admitted to bail, although I may be mistaken. In Jewett City, Connecticut, American Legion Post Commander Robert Hollis has been suspended from his command and prohibited from wearing commander's insignia on his Legion cap. Hollis, who is a pacifist and a member of the New England Committee for Nonviolent Action, has expressed disagreement with United States policy in Vietnam. He is a veteran because of his service in the front lines in Korea as a psychiatric aide. No specific charges were made against him. In a swift closed hearing, stripped him of his rank. The Connecticut affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union has offered to help him resist Legion action. Dr. Morton Reber was threatened with the loss of his job as a research specialist for the Texas Psychiatric Institute in Houston, Texas, if he participated in the Christmas Peace Vigil outside the LBJ Ranch. In Williamstown, Massachusetts, a faculty committee is investigating school superintendent Gregory Anrig's decision not to recommend tenure for high school history teacher Carlo Valone, who has frequently criticized United States policy in Vietnam. The Massachusetts Civil Liberties Union has helped to obtain legal counsel for Valone. In New Delhi, two American students who are participants in a University of Wisconsin program in India were put on probation for leading a demonstration before the United States Embassy against American policy in Vietnam. The students were warned that if they demonstrated again, they would be dismissed. Four of six members of the Cornell University Young Socialist League have been put on disciplinary action until June of this year for dispensing literature favoring the Viet Cong. A 17-year-old high school senior in Cleveland, Ohio, was suspended from school for 10 days when he refused to remove a black armband, which he said was wearing to mourn dead American soldiers and Vietnamese women, men, and children. A similar incident occurred in Des Moines, Iowa, where five junior and senior high school students were suspended for wearing armbands in school to mourn the dead and wounded in Vietnam. The Iowa Civil Liberties Union Board of Directors is now considering legal action to fight the school board. At a northern New York State University, a Naval ROTC student who is also a member of the college debate team was threatened with dismissal from the ROTC program by his commanding colonel if he took the negative position in a scheduled debate on the Vietnam War. The specific warning was withdrawn after counter-protest demonstrations were held on the campus. A member of the Naval Reserve who refused to be inducted, seeking conscientious objector status under the United States Supreme Court's Seeger decision, was subsequently taken to St. Albans Naval Hospital in New York for allegedly, quote, psychiatric reasons, unquote. However, the psychiatrist in charge maintains that the individual is being detained on orders from his commanding officer. Charges were brought to be heard before a, quote, captain's mast, unquote, but on advice of the New York Civil Liberties Union, the young man asked for a court-martial, and the charges were dropped. The New York Civil Liberties Union is now seeking a writ of habeas corpus. A letter listing a series of alleged activities and personal associations prior to enlistment in the Coast Guard was sent to an officer candidate in training. The youth was allegedly involved in only one of the listed activities. He signed a petition for students' right to travel in Cuba. Our representative in Washington is representing the officer candidate and wrote to the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Fowler, stating in his letter that the President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, and the head of Selective Service have all recently stated that protesting against the war in Vietnam is protected by the First Amendment's guarantee of free speech. Does the Coast Guard hold otherwise? After a Vietnam sit-in demonstration at Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the Selective Service Board in Ann Arbor, 39 persons were arrested on a trespassing charge. 31 of the demonstrators had student or other types of draft deferments, and since the protest, 12 have been reclassified 1A. All are University of Michigan students, though some are registered at draft boards in other parts of the country. Following this sit-in, Colonel Arthur A. Holmes, director of the Michigan Selective Service, called for the immediate induction of war protesters who had violated Selective Service regulations or had caused any interruption of procedure. After the first four 1A reclassifications were issued, and all of these were by draft boards in Michigan, National Selective Service Director Lieutenant General Louis B. Hershey gave his tacit approval to the actions, stating, through a spokesman, that Michigan, quote, apparently was following the regulations, unquote, and that the national headquarters did not plan to intercede. Despite the arrest charge of trespassing, Colonel Holmes contended that the sit-in demonstrators were violating the Selective Service law. He has informed the local draft boards of the arrest of 17 students who are non-Michigan residents and has suggested that these students might be considered delinquent for disrupting a Selective Service office. Draft delinquency is generally treated with induction. The ACLU of Michigan is handling the appeals of all but one of the reclassified students. In Austin, Texas, a request for a parade permit was denied to the Students for a Democratic Society by the City Council. Refusing the request, some councilmen made evident their opposition to the ideas SDS was seeking to support in the parade. An American Civil Liberties Union, Texas cooperating attorney appealed to the district court to set aside the ruling, and the judge enjoined the city against enforcing its ban on the parade. But the city, without informing either the SDS or the attorney, then took the matter to the Criminal Court of Appeals just before the planned parade time, produced a temporary order overruling the judge's injunction, and the district court judge and SDS leaders have been summoned to appear in the criminal court to show cause why the overruling of the district court decision should not be made permanent. In Seattle, Washington, several University of Washington campus and off-campus groups staged an anti-war demonstration. Seattle police, both in uniform and plain clothes, were present and continuously photographed all marchers and participants. Although this is in itself not unusual practice, it was done with unusual openness. When one of the protest speakers, a University of Washington professor, was doused with red paint, under circumstances which indicated that the police on the spot had ample opportunity to prevent the act. Although the paint thrower did apologize, he did so on the ground that he hadn't realized his victim was a professor. When taken into court, the graduate student who threw the paint received a suspended sentence. Neither the authorities nor the city's editorial writers issued any protest of the form of the apology. The instances of repression are numerous. Repression has occurred in the early history of the American Civil Liberties Union and is occurring now. We are a larger organization. Perhaps we are better able to meet our obligations now than we were in the early years. Certainly the job is a difficult one. The American Civil Liberties Union in January took a position that the right that a person faced with selective service had a right to conscientiously object to a particular war. The issue, the ACLU stated, is whether conscientious objection to a particular war deserves the same treatment as the pacifist's objection to participation to war in any form. ACLU believes that neither fairness nor constitutional principle will permit legal recognition of conscience to be confined to those who base it on religious doctrine. In 1965, the United States Supreme Court, in the Seeger case, ruled that, quote, the test of belief is whether a given belief that is sincere and meaningful occupies a place in the life of its possessor, parallel to that filled by the orthodox belief in God of one who clearly qualifies for the exemption, unquote. ACLU says that we deal not here merely with political protest or with dissent from policies of government. Government under law means that the conduct of those who disagree will yield to the command of government when the democratic processes have resolved the subject of debate. The individuals who should qualify as conscientious objectors to a particular war are rather those who find participation in such a war to be so great a wrong that even government's command will not relieve them of responsibility for committing that wrong. For civil libertarians, conscience so central to a man's belief becomes an aspect of religious liberty protected by the First Amendment, whether or not the objector calls his conscience religious. We will strive to have the selective service system recognize a policy under which no person shall be compelled to participate in armed conflict when he believes it to be in violation of his conscience to do so, and equally wrong to yield his conscience to his government, whether on moral, social, philosophical, or religious grounds. We shall seek to implement this position in appropriate legal cases and in campaigning for revision of the draft law to recognize this aspect of conscience. The present law extends exemption only to those who participate in war in any form. The liberalizing effect of the Seeger decision eliminates its discrimination in favor of adherence to theistic religions. The Seeger rule may provide the basis for eliminating discriminations in favor of the beliefs claimed to be religious. Many deeply held beliefs which, in the language of the Seeger case, occupy, quote, in the life of their possessors a place parallel to that filled by the God of those admittedly qualifying for the exemption, unquote, do not today denominate themselves religious. But discrimination in favor of the pacifist and against the discriminating objector needs now to be confronted. If the grant of an exemption to conscientious objectors is merely an act of grace on the part of Congress, and I think we should recognize that conscientious objection is not a constitutional right, but one legislatively granted by Congress, that it is nevertheless true that under our constitutional system, that this grace may not be extended to some and denied to others without a reasonable basis for differentiation between them. But how are we to measure what belief is sufficiently deeply held is a difficult problem. The answer, whether provided by congressional amendment to the present law or through the courts, must distinguish between convictions meriting the adjective conscientious and those which reflect no more than disagreement with the will of the government. The Seeger case gives us one rule: whether the belief occupies in the life of its possessor a place parallel to that filled by God of those admittedly qualifying for the exemption. In another formulation, the requisite belief described is as involving a higher loyalty than loyalty to this country, loyalty to God. The test then is not whether the registrant disagrees with the policies of his government, for mere disagreement fails to distinguish him from the run of ordinary citizens who are subject to the command of the law. Rather, it is whether he finds it wrong on this issue to yield his will to the command of the government, whether the government's command here will fail to relieve him of responsibility for committing the wrong he finds he would commit if he were to obey. Whether he finds it wrong to yield his will to that of government because of a belief in relationship to a God or a supreme being, because of a belief in a higher law, because of his religion, or because of something he calls moral principle or conscience. Whatever this reason, it is the fact that an issue is one on which he must assume moral responsibility. He is unrelieved by that taken by his government, and that should be crucial in determining the exemption. Senator Gruning of Alaska has introduced an amendment to the draft law, which, it is my understanding, provides for conscientious objection, or would allow for conscientious objection to a particular war. We will watch the progress of this legislation closely. The burning of draft cards has occupied the public's attention. In New York, David Miller was charged and convicted in a district court for, quote, knowingly mutilate or knowingly destroying his draft card. This four-word amendment was passed through Congress literally without debate. No hearings were held, and in both houses of Congress, only one dissenting vote, that of Representative Curtis from Nebraska, saw this amendment, this four-word amendment, through Congress. The American Civil Liberties Union of New York is defending David Miller, which is now on appeal to the Second Circuit, and is defending another young man in Iowa. The Iowa Civil Liberties Union is defending a young man in Iowa also charged with burning his draft card. I'd like to review for just a couple of minutes the legal arguments which the ACLU feels shows that indicates this amendment is unconstitutional. First, the statute charges destruction and mutilation of a notice of, or the, I'm sorry, the statute provides for mutilation or destruction of any such certificate, any registration certificate, alien certificate of non-residence, or any other certificate issued pursuant to or prescribed by the provisions of the law. We would contend that a draft card is not a certificate. It is a notice of classification. Just as plainly, it is by its own terms, it does not by its own terms purport to certify anything. The reason for this distinction is simple enough. The purpose of a registration certificate or certificate of service is to provide solemn documentary evidence to the whole world of a permanent fact that the person has registered or that he has served. The purpose of a notice is merely to inform the registrant of his classification status, one which is frequently changing and always subject to change. The plain meaning of the words, and especially the legislative history, indicate that Congress had only one intent, and that is to prohibit the destruction or mutilation of registration certificates. Another argument is that the criminal charge of burning one's draft card unconstitutionally abridges the rights to freedom of speech and assembly and to the free exercise of political rights as guaranteed by the First, Ninth, and Tenth Amendments to the Constitution. The Supreme Court has made it clear that Congress has no power to prohibit nonviolent speech advocating a lawful purpose. Political speech criticizing the conduct of foreign and military policy of the federal government is entitled to the highest degree of protection under the First Amendment. In addition to the well-established and often reiterated guarantees of the First Amendment, the right of political expression and the correlative right to be free from political suppression is likewise guaranteed by the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. This was established in the case of United Public Workers versus Mitchell and Griswold in Connecticut. Surely the right to express one's opinion on foreign policy through a peaceful combination of verbal and symbolic speech is at least as much a personal right retained by the people within the meaning of the Ninth Amendment as is the right to privacy. Turning for a moment to the form of speech, it might be argued that this is not speech, but an act. We would contend that this is symbolic speech and entitled to the same degree of protection as verbal speech. Symbolic speech is, quoting from the West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett, a primitive but effective way of communicating ideas. It's a shortcut from mind to mind. A person gets from a symbol the meaning he puts into it, and what is one man's comfort and inspiration is another's jest and scorn. In that case, they punish the refusal to engage in symbolic speech via a compulsory flag salute, or they condemn the punishing. And in the Garner versus Louisiana case, they upheld the free expression of symbolic speech. A sit-in demonstration is as much a part in the free trade of ideas as verbal expression. The form of expression is not here what's important. It does not matter whether it's through verbal symbols or through nonverbal ones. The First Amendment protects both. If a Selective Service registrant addressing a public meeting criticizing the government's foreign policy held aloft his registration certificate and said words to the effect of, quote, "I detest and execrate this piece of paper and everything for which it stands," unquote, surely the attempted punishment of such verbal action would be beyond constitutional limits. We would argue that insofar as it concerns congressional power under the First Amendment, the symbolic expression of destroying or mutilating the piece of paper in such a context creates no constitutionally significant difference. All of these are basic to the First Amendment guarantees of free speech. And yet, in utter disregard of these considerations, and in spite of them, Congress in 1965 amended Title 50, U.S. Code S-462-B3, for the express purpose of suppressing speech critical to the conduct of government foreign policy. As many citizens know and lawyers know, courts in interpreting cases, deciding cases involving the constitutionality of an act, turn for guidance to the legislative history of that act. Often this is confusing, it's ambiguous, it involves hearings, opposing points of view. But I can't think of a single instance which is more clear, more single-minded, more single of purpose than the passage of this amendment, and that is so clearly demonstrated in the legislative history of this act. On August 5, 1965, Representative Mendel Rivers, a Democrat of South Carolina, introduced the bill, House H.R. 10306, adding the words, "knowingly destroys and knowingly mutilates," subdivision 3 the entire subdivision 3 is "who forges, alters," and this is the amendment, "knowingly destroys or knowingly mutilates or in any manner changes any such certificate or any notation duly and validly inscribed thereon." This amendment was favorably reported to the Committee of the Whole House by the House Committee on Armed Services, and Representative Rivers submitted House Report 747, 89th Congress, first session, in connection with the bill. In this House report, it was stated, quote, The House Committee on Armed Services is fully aware of and shares in the deep concern expressed throughout the nation over the increasing incidents in which individuals and large groups of individuals openly defy and encourage others to defy the authority of their government by destroying and mutilating their draft cards. On August 10, 1965, Representative Rivers, speaking in support of the bill, clearly illustrated the purpose of this act. Quote, "The purpose of this bill is clear. It merely amends the draft law by adding the words knowingly destroys and knowingly mutilates draft cards. A person who is convicted would be subject to a fine up to $10,000 and or an imprisonment up to 5 years." Continuing with the quote, "It is a straightforward, clear answer to those who would make a mockery of our efforts in South Vietnam by engaging in the mass destruction of draft cards." Continuing with the quote still, "We do not want to make it illegal to mutilate or destroy a card per se, because sometimes this can happen by accident. But if it can be proved that a person knowingly destroyed or mutilated his draft card, then under the committee proposal, he can be sent to prison where he belongs. This is the least we can do for our men in South Vietnam fighting to preserve freedom, while a vocal minority in this country thumb their noses at their own government," unquote. Representative Bray of Indiana, in support of the bill, delineated its purpose. "It was to suppress expressions of contempt for the United States, to punish those who disrespect American institutions, to facilitate a rebirth of patriotic sentiment, and to end toleration of evil." Representative Bray said, quote, "The need of this legislation is clear. Beatniks and so-called campus cults have been burning their draft cards to demonstrate their contempt for the United States and our resistance to communist takeovers. Such actions have been suggested and led by college professors, professors supported by taxpayers' money. These so-called student mobs at home and abroad make demands and threats, hurl rocks and ink bottles at American buildings, publicly mutilate or burn their draft cards. They even desecrate the American flag. Chanting and screaming vile epitaphs, these mobs of so-called students and communist stooges attempt to create fear and destroy self-confidence in our country and its citizens and to downgrade the United States in the eyes of the world. This proposed legislation to make it illegal to knowingly destroy or mutilate a draft card is only one step in bringing some legal control over those who would destroy American freedom. This legislation, if passed, will be of some assistance to our country if the officers and courts charged with the enforcement of the law will have the energy, courage, and guts to make use of it. We put to you that it would be hard to find a statute whose legislative history are succinctly and unanimously set forth the purpose sought to be achieved. The evil at which this statute is directed is open defiance and contempt for national governmental authority expressed by dissident persons who disapprove of national policy. A more obvious illegitimate purpose could hardly be devised. The legislative history bears all the hallmarks of a frenzied rush to suppress dissent. There was no debate, no reflection and reasoning heard in halls of Congress. There was only a single point of view expressed, and it went unchallenged except for one solitary negative vote. For persons appearing before hearings, before local draft boards, were they to appear for the hearing with their family attorney, they would be confronted with Selective Service Regulation 16241B, which explicitly denies a registrant the right to counsel at the local board hearing. It allows a person to bring a representative if he does not speak English, clearly for the purpose of interpreting. But this regulation does not deny by indirection or by inaction. It specifically says you may not bring a lawyer. Moreover, in a local board hearing, the record of the proceedings are kept by a secretary of the board. There is no transcript made. This, perhaps, is an even more flagrant violation of due process, for it effectively denies a meaningful judicial review. The law is complicated regarding the law and facts are complicated regarding conscientious objection. I can think of few instances where an attorney would be more helpful to present evidence in a cogent fashion, to assist the local board in keeping out matters which later on court appeal would be inadmissible evidence, to guide the testimony in a succinct and meaningful pattern, to, by rulings on the, or by offering comments on the evidence and its admissibility, to keep the hearing pertinent to the issues before the hearing, and to exclude that which is clearly irrelevant to the purposes of the hearing. It's clear in our law that administrative agencies operate much the same as a local selective service board. This is power delegated by Congress to find facts. This is true of our Federal Communications Commission, of the many federal and local administrative agencies, which, because of their expertise and their knowledge, focus their fact-finding on particular issues in our society. And the court has uniformly ruled in questions of other administrative agencies that it's basic due process or basic fairness to allow a person the right to counsel, the right to an adequate record for a to guarantee the right of judicial review, the right to present witnesses, and to cross-examine witnesses presented in a situation adverse to his interest. Now, I must indicate that what little case law there is concerning this regulation has held that, or has commented, that the right to denial of right to counsel is not unconstitutional. The Civil Liberties Union has taken the position that it is, and is seeking to implement by various legal cases to establish that it is a violation of basic due process. Apart from the regulation, apparently discretion is left to local boards around the country whether or not a person having a hearing before a board is allowed to present witnesses. In some states, this has been allowed. In Michigan, for example, this has been allowed and denied by some of the same boards. Certainly, there is a need for uniformity of treatment. And just by example, if our farmers appearing before livestock boards to have a determination on prices and conditions, if broadcasters appearing before Federal Communications Commission, our airlines appearing before the CAB have the right to assistance of counsel, isn't it at least as important to guarantee an individual's rights and individual's freedom to have counsel at a local draft board hearing where the issue is the man's very belief, the man's conscience?